Hello, everyone. Today, I have the immense privilege of speaking with Professor John Lennox, distinguished mathematician, philosopher of science, and public intellectual. As Professor Emeritus of Mathematics at the University of Oxford, his work extends far beyond equations. He explores the profound connections between science, philosophy, and religion. With a career spanning decades, Professor Lennox has authored numerous books, including his latest must-read release, 2084, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humanity. He has engaged in thought-provoking debates with leading atheists like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, bringing a rigorous yet accessible approach to the deeper questions of meaning, truth, and the relationship between science and faith. Professor Lennox, it's an honor to have you on the show.
Well, thank you very much for your invitation.
Thank you very much for joining us. Professor, to begin our discussion, I would like to talk about physicist Eugene Wigner, who famously described the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in science. I'd like to break down his statement into two parts, really, and we can tackle each one separately. So first, how effective is mathematics in understanding the world? And then the second part, why is the effectiveness of mathematics considered unreasonable? So for now, let's start with the first question. In your view, Professor, how effective is mathematics in helping us understand the physical world?
It's very effective. At least, I would qualify that statement just a little, because since we don't know everything about the physical world, we can't actually say how effective it is. But in terms of our explorations to date, mathematics has been absolutely essential to our getting to grips with the physical world, because it gives us normative descriptions. And if you think, for example, of astronomy and our understanding of the planets, the richness that was supplied by Isaac Newton, for instance, to the observations of Johannes Kepler, meant that we had a firm mathematical basis for understanding the motion of the planets. Or think of the understanding that Maxwell gave of electromagnetism. That was an immense leap forward. And after that, we get Einstein and so on. And at the heart of all of this is mathematics. So it appears to be that mathematics is a supreme tool for describing the phenomena that we observe. If you omit mathematics, everything becomes pretty vague.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I understand. And now it looks like mathematics describes pretty well the physical world, and you know, maybe from the movement of electrons, you mentioned Maxwell's equation, and even the motion of galaxies. But then the second question is, why is the effectiveness, according to Eugene Wigner, considered as unreasonable?
Because of his worldview. I don't see it as unreasonable at all. And your question is very interesting, because it really shows that scientists don't come to the study of the world without preconceived ideas and worldviews. And Wigner was an atheist. And from an atheist perspective, the fact that mathematics works is absolutely astonishing. Einstein saw that very clearly, and it led to his famous statement that the only incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. Because Einstein was clever enough, as was Wigner, to see that there's a problem here. And it depends on your presuppositions. If you believe that the universe is a cosmic accident, as many extremely gifted physicists and Nobel Prize winners seem to think, then of course mathematics is unreasonably effective. Why should a mathematician thinking in here about the universe out there come up with equations that remotely connect, and that we find a language, a mathematical language, that's able to describe with considerable accuracy what is going on out there? On the other hand, from my perspective, as a Christian, believing that the reason mathematics is effective is because the same creator who created the universe outside of us also created the human mind inside of us. And being a rational creator, therefore, it seems to me fairly natural to expect that we can understand something of the universe. And in fact, the basic doctrine of the Judeo-Christian tradition, the Bible, indicates that study of the universe will be a very rewarding thing. And that particular verse of the Psalms is still on the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge where Maxwell worked. So it depends entirely where you're coming from. For atheists, it's unreasonably effective. For Christians, it's reasonably effective. Or theists, there are many different kinds of theists in the great three great monotheistic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It is entirely reasonable. But I think you see that science here is not neutral. The fact that mathematics works is pointing to something much deeper, I think, that begins to undermine the atheistic worldview of Victor.
Absolutely. Professor, do you see mathematics as something we invent as human beings, or like, for example, language, or something we discover, like the laws of physics?
I think it's both.
It's both.
Yes, because, again, coming from my biblical presuppositions, human beings have been dignified by being made in the image of God. And God is creator. That's the fundamental idea. So he's made us capable of certain kinds of creation. We're made in his image. He's a rational creator. And at a much lesser level, of course, he has made us rational creators. And in my field of mathematics, pure mathematics, we invent new ideas all the time. But then one comes to ask, do these new ideas actually, can they tell us anything more about nature? In other words, are they applicable? Some are not. Those that are begin to make you think, well, God is a divine mathematician. He knew it all before. And of course, there's a wonderful story about a very famous pure mathematician called Pál Erdős. And he was a Hungarian mathematician, dead now, but a very friendly man who traveled the world. And he would collaborate with hundreds of different mathematicians. And he would constantly say, it's in the book. It's in the book, in some kind of Platonic notion, where all these theorems that we think that we discover or make up are already there. I'm not sure I completely subscribe to that, because I do think there is an element of genuine creativity that we can perform. And anyway, even if we settled that question, I don't know how we would settle it, actually, the question you've asked. And so I'm happy to travel on two tracks in this whole issue and keep my mind open.
Okay. You've mentioned now the Platonic nature mentioned by this mathematician, the Hungarian mathematician, which the name is escaping me.
Pál Erdős.
Pál Erdős, okay. Actually, Sir Roger Penrose, the Nobel Prize winner, argues that mathematics exists independently in a Platonic realm as well, beyond space and time. And, you know, other possibilities that we can think of for the essence of mathematics can be, you know, maybe a mental essence or a physical essence or even something entirely fictional. Based on all these possibilities, where do you stand, Professor? Which one do you see is more likely or maybe the most compelling?
Well, I'm sympathetic to a lot of what Penrose writes. But what interests me is mathematics gives us information. And mathematical descriptions are not physical. They're actually non-physical. And that, to my mind, is a strong indicator that any materialistic interpretation of the universe must be totally inadequate, indeed false, because the very existence of mathematics that describes the universe gives the lie to that. Another way of looking at that is to comment on the fact that we live, as people say, in an information age. And information is not physical, although some people have tried very hard to claim that it is, arguing that we usually get information on some kind of physical substrate, just as I'm receiving information from you on a screen, which involves pixels making up a picture. So there's a physical dimension to it. But the information is not the pixels. It's carried on them, but it's not there. It is a non-physical entity. And some mathematicians, and I go with them, will argue that the existence of information as a fundamental quantity, not reducible to mathematics and physics, is one of the greatest arguments against a materialistic interpretation of the universe that we have, and a very powerful one.
Okay. So based on what you're saying and what you previously said as well, you hinted, or you actually said, that it looks like there is a deeper connection between our mental capacity and mathematics and the structure of reality. It looks like it's being suggested that there is a rational mastermind behind all of it.
Yes.
Correct? This is what you're saying. Now, I've read recently, or I've saw a like an interview with Stephen Wolfram, the inventor of the software Mathematica, and he was saying that he was suggesting that our mathematics is just one of many possible mathematical systems. So if this is true, do you think this weakens the argument that mathematics reflect an ultimate truth?
Not really, because I've read a bit of Wolfram, but I would be interested to see what these other mathematical systems actually are. What is the evidence for their existence? It's very easy to claim that our mathematics is only one, and it may be. But what do you mean by our mathematics? Mathematics is a vast array of very different fields already. There's a huge difference between quantum mechanics and, for example, and geometry. And we could go on and on with analysis, etc., 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 so that we already have a vast range. So when he's talking about another kind of mathematics, he would need, I think, to introduce us to some elements of what it could possibly mean. Now, he may be arguing that other kinds of mathematics exist, but we cannot think them. Our minds are not built to think them. Well, that's fine, but that doesn't get us any further, to be frank. I'm quite open to the fact that our mathematics may well be limited. In fact, I'm even more open to the fact that science itself, by its very nature, is limited in the questions it can answer. There's more to the universe than the natural sciences that it can reveal, but they can point towards it. And one of them is what you said, that is the existence of a rational mind behind the universe, which I feel that the natural sciences point to increasingly clearly.
Absolutely. I would like to shift gears now and talk about artificial intelligence, AI, and the limits of our mathematical understanding. Do you think one day AI will be able to understand aspects of the universe that we human beings will not be able to understand using our human mathematics, because we will be simply lacking like the conceptual framework to do that?
Well, a question of lacking a conceptual framework is one thing. A question of increasing our computing power is another thing. If you look at it this way, forget artificial intelligence for a moment, but the existence of powerful computers has enabled us to penetrate much further into the cosmos than we can with our own brains, because we couldn't do the calculations. They're too sophisticated. We might be able to do them in principle, but in practice we cannot do them because they involve so many operations. And therefore, building on that, it seems to me that artificial intelligence coupled to supercomputers may well give us further insights into the cosmos than we could do with the equipment we've got at the moment. For instance, the way in which AI can deal with photographs of outer space and, in a sense, fill in the things we cannot immediately see may be a useful way to go in the future. And also, AI is being used, as you probably know, in astrophysics to catalogue the galaxies and work out which ones are similar to other ones and so on, and help us spot new events. So that at the level of being a tool, AI is going to enhance our human capacities. And I like to think I'm looking at you, as you can see, with a pair of glasses. They are enhancing my vision. If I took them off, you would be blurred. So there's a technology that's helping me. Well, at its best, AI is a technology that can help us. Of course, when I say that, I must add what I always say is that any technology tends to be like a knife. You can use a sharp knife for surgery or you can use it for murder. And so the knife of AI has got all kinds of ethical problems. But on the positive side, use in science, I think one of the most spectacular things that was done by the Sam Altman and the people in working out the structure, the folding problem of proteins, I mean, that is just a spectacular triumph of using artificial intelligence that was reckoned to be way beyond the most capable of scientists. And they could clumsily work out, a scientist or two working for several years could work out the folding of one, but now they've worked out the folding of most. And that kind of quantum leap in the capacity of a system to organize the data and give us insight way beyond any that we had before. I don't expect that solution of the folding mechanism to be the last triumph in the realm of artificial intelligence.
I see. I mean, no doubt AI has tremendous potential to advance human discoveries and human knowledge. However, you mentioned in your book that Ian McGilchrist, the British psychiatrist and neuroscientist, thinks that AI should stand for, and I quote, artificial information processing and not artificial intelligence.
Yes.
Can you explain further what do you exactly mean by
that? Well, I think that's reasonable. I think one of the problems is that we anthropomorphize this particular space very much, and it is very misleading. Way back at the beginning of artificial intelligence, as you may recall from my book, I mention an article that was written by one of the pioneers, Joseph McRae Melichamp, and whom I've met. And he wrote an article with the lovely title, "The Artificial in Artificial Intelligence is Real." In other words, the word artificial in the phrase artificial intelligence is real. It's not real intelligence. And the problem is many people think it is, so that you have to explain to them, going back to Alan Turing at the Imitation Game, that leading AI researchers like Peter Norvig and so on are not trying to make intelligence. What they're trying to do is very effectively play the simulation game and simulate human intelligence. And they're quite happy with that. So that using their use of the word artificial intelligence is actually describing simulated intelligence, and a lot of it is, as McGilchrist says, information processing. And I think he has a point, because the more we use words that we normally restrict to humans, like learning and machine learning, the more we confuse the situation so that people don't realize that what's in front of us is a computer that does not think in the way humans think at all.
Okay, I see. And so AI is just now the start of the current discoveries in this space. However, you also mention concepts such as AGI and even ASI. So AGI standing for Artificial General Intelligence, and also ASI, Artificial Super Intelligence. Can we briefly maybe explain the difference between these concepts? And do you believe we will one day be able to reach these milestones?
Well, those are two very separate questions. They're only milestones if they actually are in a journey that's possible. But that we come back. Asking for the distinction is important because they get all confused in people's minds. Very briefly, AI or narrow AI, the stuff that works at the moment, replicates or does something, simulates something that normally requires human intelligence, like analyzing X-rays. It does one single thing and one thing alone that normally requires human intelligence, recognizing a face among a million faces, that kind of thing. AGI, which is the hope of some people, is, as the name suggests, making a system that is able to simulate everything that human beings can do. And artificial superintelligence would be doing that, but doing it much faster and much better and much more. And there seem to me to be two levels, two avenues of research in this. One is to take existing human beings and enhance them. This is the Yuval Noah Harari kind of project. Although he's not a scientist or an engineer, he's a historian. But he has this grandiose idea that we're going to engineer existing human beings and turning them into gods, essentially, as he puts it, turning them into superintelligences. There's then another school of thought which sees that one of the main problems with human intelligence is that it is attached in some way to biological organisms and they die. And therefore, the idea comes up that's popular in many films and books, science fiction films and science fiction books, I should say, of constructing some kind of artificial intelligence with a non-inorganic base, like silicon, so that there are people, and I've met some of them, who believe that eventually a way will be found of constructing such an AGI and of uploading the contents, at least, of a human brain or mind onto them so that people can get some kind of eternal life. And Harari was hoping for that. And that has led to a frenzy of people having their brains frozen in the hope that they'll be thawed out on the day that that is able to be done.
Yeah, I mean, this is a little bit against the classical understanding of what a human being is, right? This is what I believe human beings are.
Well, that's the important thing. What you're now saying is a hugely important thing. And it's what, one of the reasons I got into all of this, that I could see that it is raising questions about, as you put it, the classical understanding of what a human being is, and is in a way degenerating that. It thinks it's elevating it, but it isn't.
Correct. And then, correct me if I'm wrong, to me, the classical understanding of what a human being is like a body and a soul and a mind that are, so spirit, soul or mind and body, inseparable, correct? This is how we understand it classically.
Yes. Yes, with a caveat, because the idea Certainly they are inseparable in us as we are now, but the question of what survives after death and so on is another question, and there are different beliefs about that. That if the body dies, does the soul survive? I tend to believe that it does. But then I have confidence that in the end, what will happen to bodies is that they will be resurrected. Well, one of the striking things, as you've probably seen in my book, that when I meet people telling me about this marvelous AGI future, I say, you're too late. And they say to me, but we haven't done it yet. I said, but you see, the solution to the problem of physical death has already been done, in that God raised Christ 2,000 years ago from the dead. And also, the wonderful thing about that is, the message is that if we trust him, then we ourselves will be uploaded eventually into another world. And I think there's much more evidence for the truth of that than there is for Harari's scenarios. But that's another matter.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. So we've already touched, in a way, then on the concept of transhumanism, correct? So does transhumanism mean exactly what you just described, like ASI, or it's something beyond that as well?
No, I think transhumanism starts further down the line. It's starting with us as humans and enhancing us. And if you read Harari, Homo Deus, carefully, you'll see that what he suggests is that we'll use biological engineering and cyborg engineering, possibly, that is, adding mechanical or machines to human beings to make a hybrid being that is part human, part machine, which will exceed our current abilities and be one step on the way in going beyond human. Transhuman means beyond human as it is at the moment. And they fully expect to be able to do that. Now, that's a hugely dangerous thing, especially, well, let me put it this way. It's one thing to enhance my eyesight by scientific technology, which can be quite clever. It's another thing completely to change my genetic specification so that all humans or all beings that are descended from me have had scientists changing that specification. And this is a topic on which C.S. Lewis was absolutely brilliant. Even in 1940, he saw the danger of it. And he saw that if a group of scientists take the germline of human beings and change it, what they're producing is not human, it's an artifact. And he's got this famous and chilling phrase where he said the final triumph of humanity will be the abolition of man, the abolition of humanity, because what they will create is no longer human, but an artifact, something made by human ability, both engineering and genetic and everything else.
Okay, I see. So this leads us to a quote as well that I've read in your book, involving Orwell and Huxley. Orwell, and I quote, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us, while Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us. And based on the advances that we are currently witnessing in AI and technology, as a human civilization, who do you think is more likely to be right? Or maybe both?
Well, I think your last point is the thing. We seem to be doing both simultaneously. We love our technology, and yet we have a love-hate relationship with it. We're disturbed by what it's doing to us, especially what it's doing to young people in terms of what's online and Facebook and all this kind of thing. So that we have both, and all the drugs are there, all the things that people love, and yet the things they love destroy them. And that is one of the tragedies of the contemporary world, that we're getting both Orwell and Huxley full blast in every direction. And it's quite remarkable to read their books again, you know, just to see how much they realized. Of course, there is a sense in which once you give rein to your own thinking about what might be possible, it's not long before you come up with the kind of stuff that's in Huxley and Orwell. I think one of the most disturbing things, though, about the Orwell vision is the move towards totalitarianism. And I was interested to go to a lecture just recently in Oxford where Peter Thiel, the financier, PayPal, all of that, was saying that from his perspective as a technocrat, he could see that the world is moving towards totalitarianism. All the Big Brother elements are there. They're more there in certain parts of the world, like China and Russia, than they are here, but they're coming here. The surveillance society. And of course, that raises the question, does it not, that will be put to many people in increasing intensity. And that is, do you want to be secure? Well, if you do, you'll have to give up your freedom. And that tension between freedom and security is a very, very big deal, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And in the midst of all these advancements and rapid changes, do you believe, Professor, we should regulate the development of AI?
Well, of course we should regulate it. But regulation of technology, there's a fundamental difficulty in doing that. And that is that the technology develops much faster than the ethics that underpin it. And the drive to be number one in AI is a drive for supreme power. It was Vladimir Putin, after all, who said the person or nation that controls AI will control the world. And there may be a very real sense in which that's true. So there's a race for power and control. And it's quite obvious, looking at the world, that the biggest power blocks are putting billions into AI because they realize its potential. And they want to be the first to be there. But the result of that could be enslaving not only their own people, but all the rest of us. It's a very serious situation that we're in. So your question becomes very important. But how do we regulate it? Regulation of technology or anything else when you've got a number of blocks of power. If they've got equal strength, it's easier. But if one nation gets all the power and the others say, we've got to regulate your technology, all they have to do is turn around and say, and what will you do if we don't? And that is the danger. That kind of utilitarian ethic fails when there are non-equal centers of power. And we're dealing with that danger. And we shall increasingly deal with it because it is very much a struggle for power. And the major powers of the world, of course, can see that.
Yes, absolutely. And we see increasingly in recent times people who are like technocrats getting involved in into politics, like, for example, Elon Musk now. Do you think these are not coincidences? These are like done with views to kind of be more like of decision makers when it comes to building those worldwide regulation that will probably benefit the development of AI, but also maybe provide control to some groups versus others?
Well, it might be the latter. It is inevitable, if people want power, that it's power over others. And what technology like AI is doing is putting an immense amount of power and concentrating it in the hands of very few people. in the sense that you can imagine a situation where it will be easy to fire thousands of people just like that at the touch of a button without consultation and all the rest of it. And we're getting very near to that in one country in the world at least. And it remains to be seen just what that means, because what is obvious is it's bringing a great deal of distress and uncertainty and fear, actually, about this kind of development, because it has a destabilizing effect. Now, from the very beginning of AI, the job loss question was very much at the center. But I think that's accelerating as people discover that they can be fired very simply and in thousands in various areas of government and elsewhere in a country. And I suspect we haven't heard the last of that. So they're all very worrying developments because of the difficulty of holding to account the people who are doing it. Because if you've got enough power, you just don't care what people do.
Yes, absolutely.
Or say.
And you mentioned now job loss. Do you believe that job loss will accelerate in the next 5 years to an extent where it's going to create a crisis on that level?
I think it may already be creating a crisis. And we must remember that if we're talking mainly of the West, that's one thing. But if you go to the two-thirds world, there's an additional problem. I was in South Africa some time ago talking about AI and jobs, and they said, look, we hear the message that people ought to get jobs in AI and become educated technologically so that they can take advantage of these developments. But we don't have the educational infrastructure to give them that education. So the result is going to be a massive job losses and people who cannot work. There's no work for them to do. And some people thinking about the future have thought about that and given a very grim picture of a world in which many people would be unemployable, to use Harari's term for that. And that is very grim indeed.
I see. Well, indeed, the challenges that AI is presenting us with are many, but also there are lots of benefits. Do you see any? What are the benefits, or let's say the advantages that you see can be used safely by us human beings, and with the right regulation, could probably, on the contrary, contribute to a positive development for us, for humanity?
Well, I think there are many positives. As I said, AI. The AI that's working, that is narrow AI, is like a knife that can be used for good or ill. And okay. Some of the positive advantages are to be seen in medicine, for example.
Medicine.
There have been huge successes in the development of drugs, of vaccinations, all this kind of thing, of speeding up medicine, of organizing hospitals more efficiently. There are many, many, many positive things have shown that AI can be extremely useful.
Okay.
And those benefits alone would be worthwhile. Of course, there are the lesser benefits, which many of us take advantage of, but we don't realize that there's a hidden sting in them. For example, if I buy a book very soon on my smartphone, there will be a suggestion, people that bought that book will buy this book. What we don't know, often realize, is that we're leaving a data trail, and that data trail is being sold on to companies without our permission. And that leads to another huge ethical issue with artificial intelligence, copyrights, the books on which ChatGPT is trained, including my own, for example, and all of this kind of thing. So there are built-in dangers that we need to be aware of. But it's interesting that most of us voluntarily carry this tracker around with us that's recording everything, maybe, that we're doing. And we're voluntarily giving up an amount of freedom just to have the use of this machine. But what that's going to lead to, I just don't know.
Okay. Well, Professor, it was a fascinating discussion. I would stay hours and hours asking you questions, but I want to respect your time, and I want to ask
you a final question.
Based on your upbringing, your beliefs, and what's happening currently in the technological world, what would be an advice that you could provide to maybe technological leaders, based on what you believe and what you think is the right thing to do?
Well, I think the main thing is that there's more to the world than technology. Science and technology give us answers to many questions, but they're mostly the how questions. How can I reach that goal? How can I solve this problem in business or in science and so on? But the why question is much more important. And they don't answer the why question. Why am I? What is the purpose of my life? What is a human being? And so on. And that's where I feel we need something more. And I'm interested in the fact that I observe an increasing number of public intellectuals who are telling us, look, there must be something more. People like Jordan Peterson, Tom Holland, etc., etc. And I believe that there's been a reawakening, actually, for these people to reconsider what arguably made the West great, and that is the Judeo-Christian, legacy from the Bible. I mean, just take the fundamental notion of human rights that men and women are equally valuable, because they're created in the image of God. Now, as Tom Holland noticed in his book and noticed in his life, that didn't come from Greece or Rome. They didn't believe in the equality, but it did come from the Christian tradition. And so on and so forth. In our culture, there is so much embedded of what we would call good and want to hold on to. But tragically, we're allowing another worldview to dominate the public space. And I think that is a very dangerous trend. We need to get back to, well, we've lost our moorings, our moral moorings, because, as someone put it, we think we came from nowhere and we're not going anywhere. And anyhow, our lives have no meaning. That's a very bleak outlook. And it's for that reason, I think, that the Christian faith offers something that it has offered for centuries. And it can be rationally explained. It's not, as so many people think, irrational or anti-science. I'm passionate about science. But all these myths that God and science conflict and so on, I've spent my life writing books to refute that we should have our minds open and look for things that will give us an anchor and a meaning in life and give us a meta-narrative, if you like, a big story into which we can fit. And I find that the God story that's in the Bible, I can fit into it perfectly, and it gives me real hope and a reason for existing.
Absolutely. And for our listeners, I highly recommend purchasing and reading 2084, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humanity by Professor John Lennox. It's a fascinating read. And on that, thank you very much, Professor. It was a fascinating discussion. Thank you again.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.